Some of you have seen this kind of diagram before. I'm new. Because this is a group of some people who are newer and mostly people who have been doing this for a while and some for a long time, I have to have a fairly wide spread. But this this diagram is a super way to talk about training. Anyway, so here's the diagram. Very mysterious, right? Start by writing a word. I can find the right pen here. If anyone would like to sniff my pens here, the yellow one smells like lemon. This one smells like strawberry, I think it is, or cherry. And the black one smells like licorice, which is my favorite. You can also very easily get the end of your nose covered if you're sniffing them. So, we start with one word at the bottom. This is a diagram of what I call the great circulation. And there's what's called a lower gate on it. And that's the need gate. Some of you are familiar with this, but I always talk about it in a little different way because it always comes up in a little different way. So the first thing we need to ask is how does need manifest, essentially? And there's one... always one signal of need. In a general sense, there's one signal of need. Anyone want to hazard what it is? What's common to all need as a signal? No, that's not the signal. Feeling. Some state of feeling. So we can put, in parentheses down here, we can put feeling. Not all feeling seems to signal need, but painful feeling signals need. And since we're talking about spiritual need here, we have to think about the kind of feelings that signal spiritual need. And they're feelings like grief and anger and desire, you know, craving, sadness, feelings of worthlessness, helplessness, right? Now, the way people usually talk about these things is these are the things that are in the way that you need to get rid of. And that's what psychological therapy is aimed at. Psychological therapy is aimed at getting rid of the feeling that's bad and replacing it with a feeling that you like. But I just want to point out that that's not the purpose of spiritual training and contemplative practice especially. That's not the purpose. It is not the purpose to get rid of the signal. Feeling is a signal. So it's not the purpose to get rid of that. I don't know, I've hammered away at this for years and probably do it till the day I die, where I'll probably be feeling my need pretty strongly. It is not the purpose to get rid of that painful feeling. This is where religion and psychology diverge right at the outset. Where genuine contemplative religion diverges. And you have to understand that. This is a gateway down here. And it's a gateway for the need to enter the circulation that's going to help it. Remember, we distinguish in the need from the feeling that signals it. It's the actual need that has to get the help, not the feeling. See? The feeling will change when the need is satisfied, the need is met. So, this is a circulation, a cycling that's going to happen. And this, in general, this is a circulation of, it's a description is of conversion. It's called conversion. But here, conversion doesn't mean that you change your label from, say, a Christian to a Buddhist. It means that the need gets into the circulating water of the spirit, and the need undergoes a transformation. And this is the single greatest secret of religion, is the nature of this transformation. And I have to say, just right off the bat, that I haven't run into any teacher anywhere, any time, that explains this like Master Jiyu did, or that understood it, as seems to comprehend it and know how to put it in practical, immediate terms like she did. I don't know. I've never run into anyone who did it as well. I've done it as well. And you can only do it if you've undergone it. And you come to know it thoroughly through experience. You can only explain it the way she does. She just describes her experience and generalizes from that. So, now we need to understand something else about this gate. This gate works two ways. It works going in and it works going out. And what you want to have, ideally, what you're trying to develop is a one-way valve, where it goes in but not out. And this is the reason why you have precepts. The precepts are a one-way valve that prevents it going out. So let's take a precept such as do not be mean in giving dharma or wealth. Let's take that precept and just think about that for a moment. What does it mean to say that that precept acts like a one-way valve? It means that when you're in a situation where your need is manifesting relative to that particular precept, say you're wanting to be ungenerous when generosity is called for. Say you're being mean-spirited, stingy, and frightened and timid, where you need to be big-hearted and generous. The precept is a reminder to go ahead and take the plunge and do the generous, big-hearted thing and not to be mean-spirited. When you act on the mean-spiritedness, you leave the valve open both ways and it leaks out. What wants to rise and circulate just dissipates itself. And that is true of all the precepts. This is a different view also from worldly morality or from most religious morality. See, this is not about accumulating virtue and becoming a super person. That's totally irrelevant from the point of view of contemplative. It's an illusion, basically, from the point of view of contemplative training. You're not trying to make yourself a super person. You're not trying to amass a great mass of virtue. Common misunderstanding, people practicing religion. After all, we're not trying to become God. We're trying to be a vessel through which our need can reach God and get God's help. See? A big difference. You're trying to replace bad ego with good ego. You're trying to transcend self to realize the true self, that which we call Buddha nature, the eternal. infinite love. So let that infinite love bathe the need. So, I'll go to my yellow pen. Let's assume that we've got up to where things are circulating here. This is the direction of the circulation here. And you can actually, you can kind of show, you could show a dotted line of where it's, kind of the need comes in kind of grotty, pained and confused and grotty. And it's going up, 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 up. What is it that makes it go up? Well, it's basically, it goes up by itself. You don't make it go up. There's another big mistake, and connected with that virtue one, that if I be Mr. Super Sincere, doubly or triply sincere, I'll make it happen. But all you have to be is just as sincere as you can be. You don't have to be super anything. It naturally rises. It naturally rises. What enables it to rise? Getting out of the way of its rising. What enables that to happen? Pure meditation. What is pure meditation? Pure meditation is allowing the heart to naturally look to the eternal. Allowing your own Buddha nature to look to the eternal Buddha nature, universal Buddha nature. Like calling to like responding to like. See? If that happens, that's why this quiet sitting is, or contemplative prayer, is the heart of all contemplative practice, and why everyone from Dogen to John of the Cross, you know, says, everyone who does it says, this is enough. Just do a lot of this. Why even the Bible says, pray without ceasing. Doesn't mean you're on the phone all the time to God, like people think of prayer. It means you let your heart always look to the eternal. You allow it to do what it naturally is its nature to do by not impeding it. And that's what we call meditation. So how is meditation described? Don't try to think. Don't try not to think. Just sitting with no deliberate thought is the important aspect of meditation. What does that mean? Well, don't willfully grasp after anything. And don't willfully push anything away. And if you remain in that non-willful state, that which is innate in you will happen. You can't stop it happening if you do the right thing to get out of it. It's the way of the natural process of this circulation. Now, this red circle at the top represents the eternal. But you have to understand that this is all the eternal, including the need. So the need is the raw material of enlightenment. And in the very term enlightenment has no meaning unless there's something to be enlightened. So this is a chunk of ignorance and pain, of confusion and pain, that needs to get into the water and circulate. The water of Buddha nature and circulate. And there are signs that a teacher learns through their own experience primarily to look for when to recognize when this is happening. Mostly it's just intuitive, but there's also signs. And one of the signs, it's a classic sign that all the mystics talk about, is that there is a longing arises in you. Santideva, a Buddhist teacher who lived umpteen years ago, said, "This thought of enlightenment has arisen in me, I know not how. It is as a blind man who finds a jewel in a dung heap. This need is the dung heap. The jewel is the jewel of enlightenment, and you're groping around. Once your groping becomes a non-willful groping, it starts to chug, and it does its thing." This is also why Dogen said, "The means of training are thousandfold, and pure zazen must be done." Pure meditation is the only thing that really allows this to happen. Some people mistakenly believe that it takes lifetimes over, do good works in this lifetime and amass tons of merit, so in a future life, someone can inherit that merit and really go for it. But I say, well, why leave the fun part for someone in the future when you're dead? Why not go for the fun part ourselves? So there's an upward and a downward part of the cycle. And the upward part is the part where your longing is rising to the eternal. And the downward part is the part where the eternal blessing or grace and compassion is flowing to the need. And you have to think of the need, there's help to think of the need as being released like these little dots into the stream in little chunks, and as they circulate, that the transformation happens. Now here's another thing about, this explains something about the nature of the world. People very easily pin their hopes on external solutions to the problems of suffering. See, we'll be smart and we'll just fix what's busted and then we'll all be content. But the people who have all their material needs met still aren't any more content, and often much less so than other people. So obviously that's not the answer. And just being happy all the time isn't the answer either. First of all, you can't do it. But secondly, even if you could, so what? Because the need will still be under there. Even if you can have a whole lifetime of being happy, what need is in there is still going to have to get met one day in some lifetime. And it will occasionally send its twinge of pain through the happiness to remind you that it's there, buried. This is also true of human relationship. No human relationship will deal with this problem. We'll do what needs to be done here. It's impossible. How can another person who's in the same state as me fix me? That's ridiculous. Except I don't wish to ridicule it. It's one of the commonest illusions in the world, and one that I've suffered from at times myself considerably. One glimpses something of the compassion of the eternal in someone else and grabs. And that's the more brighter side of falling in love. But then it never quite turns out like that, because no one actually is the eternal. No one can be the eternal for someone else. It doesn't mean people don't love each other truly, because they do. So this is something that has to be undertaken essentially alone. and one can undertake it. It's helpful to do it, to do your training with other people. And even when with other people, when you sit on that cushion and face the wall, you know, it's what's going on in your head and your feelings and your body. That's what's there, isn't it? It's the nature of longing that if the out valve is closed, what has been experienced as an externalized longing will transfer over to the eternal. And at that point, when that happens for the first time, one literally falls in love with God. And the, and it's another thing that mystics talk of. You don't see it as much, and you have to read between the lines to see it in Zen. You see it very plainly in the Christian mystics, and you see it in the Shin mystical writings, you know, the devotional school of Buddhism, devotional side of Buddhism, but it's there in Zen just as much. But we do the litany of the great compassionate one, one of the scriptures we do the most, and the latter part of the most of the litany of the great compassionate one is this cry of love and ecstasy. When the need got the arrow of help met the arrow of need, and the two dissolved into each other. So with each form of need, there is a transformation possible which turns that need into enlightenment, an aspect of enlightenment. This is another thing that Rim Master constantly talked of, is this is the real nature of conversion. And this is the great mystery of religion. No one knows how this happens, essentially. You can describe it in diagrams. You can experience it. You can experience it. You still don't know how it happens. It's a miracle. It's the one true miracle I know of, is that transformation. And you can literally experience it. And feeling signals the transformation as well as the need. So you can actually experience fear transforming into gratitude. And the longing for external things transforming into the longing and love for the eternal. And in the first stage of this transformation are this upward path. The rising of our love to the eternal. And then there is the bathing, the eternal bathing, our need in compassion, experience of grace, they call it in Western religion. And that just feeds right back in. Down at the bottom here, some more need feeds in, gets picked up, circulates through. When it reaches the top here, is the moment of enlightenment. Essential moment of transformation, often accompanied not only by change of feeling, but of insight as well. Always something about our relationship to the eternal. And at the deepest levels, the dissolving into the eternal. In this superior activity of no mind. You ever wondered about that line? In this superior activity of no mind, lo, the wooden figure sings and the stone maiden dances. How does a wooden figure sing and the stone maiden dance? When the universe is transformed in a moment. And one sees things as they truly are. When experiences things as they truly are. Now, some people think that the purpose of religion is to have that experience. And this is a great distinction between Soto Zen and Rinzai. The Rinzai school opted for the latter, and it's a mistake from the Soto point of view. the purpose of religion is this process, is to give oneself wholeheartedly to this process, to give one's life into the hands of the Eternal, and to allow this to happen. And whatever happens in the process, whatever point it is, whether it's at the point of the deep pain or it's the point of the bliss, it doesn't matter. No one does this truly without going through hell, their own private hell, and going through it sometimes for years. And that's where you just have to hang on to your faith for dear life and trust the process and never give up on it. That's also why, you know, faith is emphasized at every stage of this, not just at the beginnings. Well, and initially you have faith, then you get the goodies, and then you're set for life. It doesn't work that way, because there's more need. Dealing with one lump of need just brings another one up to the surface, ready to go. It brings another one to the gate, and it starts breaking up into lumps and manifesting. And so this is not a path of happiness. The path of genuine training and enlightenment, which is one process, is not a path of happiness. I guarantee you will be utterly miserable if you do this at times, but not all the time. Why should we have to keep being utterly miserable? Because there's more need packed into a human being than you can possibly imagine. You're a bucket of need, spiritual need, not just from this lifetime, but much, much more from previous lives, of which you have inherited the need. They're not your life, they're someone else's life, some other being's life. Nonetheless, someone had to pick up the need, and you're the unfortunate beneficiary of the need, which is an accurate way to put it. It doesn't always feel fortunate, and it is a beneficiary. You are the beneficiary of the need. Here points out another thing that I always love to talk a little bit about, is this immense compassion of the Eternal, that all that need that's out there eventually gets dealt with. And time is no obstacle, because the Eternal's got forever. All that need eventually, you know, if you like watch the news or listen to the news, read the news, mostly what you're watching is need getting accumulated. That's a good way to talk about it. This is the need in the making. Someone's going to have to pick this up. When I see something about someone's blown themselves up or something in some foreign country or here for that matter, under the influence of a delusion and hurting other people in the process often, I think, well, some poor devil got to pick that up and help it get cleaned up. And it will happen. That's the thing. And each of us is that poor devil. You don't have to like look to some future. Each of us is that poor devil. We're chock full of it. So if it were all to come up at once, it would just obliterate you. I mean that literally. If it were all to come at once, I mean, your feeling and your experience, it would just obliterate you. So it gets fed a little at a time. And that's the explanation of what's called gradual training. And the fact that little bit can be enlightened is the explanation for what's called sudden training, sudden enlightenment. Once the kind of preliminary layers are dealt with, then some of the bigger, deeper, more anguish and confused chunks can really get in there and start to break up into major component chunks like these kind of icebergs breaking off the face of a glacier, you know. And as they come in, then you're really in for it then for a while. So each time that happens and the rug gets pulled out from under you again, and you then it's helpful if you remember, well, this is just reminding me, this pain is reminding me of my need, of the need that I've inherited from the past. This is reminding me of the need. So what is the position in a practical sense that I can take to help that need? Well, the position that you can take right off the bat is simply to acknowledge the need is there. You'd think that this is the most obvious thing in the world, wouldn't you? But I'm living proof that it's not. Because so often, when I get hit by another chunk, you know, it's the last thing I seem to think of. Oh, this is reminding me I need to actually call out for help. Here's where I need to cry out for help. Why is it that that's so deeply ingrained in us? It's because so much of that need has to do with deep conviction of unworthiness. A deep conviction of unworthiness. And when there's sufficient conviction of unworthiness, it blocks the thought that you can cry out for help. Now, if you look at the Litany of the Great Compassionate One, we recite that again this evening. So when you recite that, you notice we recite it in the evening, recite it again in the morning. When you recite that again, listen to those first lines. All is defilement, defilement, earth, earth, need. Down at the Lord Gate. Do the work within my heart, crying for help. O great victor, I hold on, hold on. Faith, persevering in faith. So when the chunk, a big chunk of need hits, there's a big need to get down on your knees and bow and ask for help. See, you don't have to just tough it out, and you don't have to just sweep it under the carpet. And you don't have to go all to pieces either. You can just turn the need and the pain into the motivation for bowing, which is what it naturally wants to be. And looking to the Buddha nature, letting your heart start to rise to the eternal. It's a funny thing, but you could even say that you're if you allow it to happen, you're actually lifted on the pain. It wants to go up. It wants to. But people dig in against it. And the more you dig in against it, the more furiously the need signals. And so the more intense the pain becomes. This is also true for physical pain, by the way. The more you fight it, the more you feel it. And the more it irritates you and distresses you. The more you open your heart to it, the less it will torment you. Because it's mostly the fight that's tormenting. That's not to say you don't take aspirin for a headache or whatever, you know. You don't go to the doctor when you broke your leg, that kind of thing. You have to be practical. It's the refusal to accept is the initial obstacle. And, you know, why shouldn't it be? Because, you know, we don't want to be in pain. We know that if we open ourselves to it, we're going to get hit this wave of it. And that's just what happens with spiritual pain. It really, there's nothing more excruciating, no physical pain more excruciating than pure, essential spiritual pain of the worst kind, the most intense kind. It's just pure pain. And you feel utterly awful. But that's not the end of the story. When you get where you feel utterly awful, and you can acknowledge it, I feel utterly awful, help. See, that's progress. Reverend Matthew said, pound into us, look up. Look up. Don't look down. Look up. That's the help. Crying for help. And then take the step that helps you be helped. Don't just be a passive crier for help. Then sit up straight in the presence of the Buddhas and ancestors and let the thing start to rise. In other words, do meditation. And so often people hit this point of the pain, and that's where they leave the meditation behind. Because after all, sitting there looking at the wall makes that pain more naked and puts you right in the middle of it. That's what's going to help it, you see. Nowadays, you know, people go to a shrink and they get a drug, you know, to change their mood. But it doesn't deal with the need. And so the need will sit under there waiting. And it's just putting it off. Time of dealing with it. Reverend Massey used to say, you know, people, when they don't have enough faith, they go to a psychologist. When you have enough faith, you do it the religious way. And there's no judgment in that. I'm not saying anyone's bad to do it the other way, but I'm just saying if you're going to do it this way, don't try to combine it with the psychological way, because you won't be able to make it work. If you're going to do it the psychological way, then do that and leave this. But if you're going to do it this way, then dump the psychiatric drugs and do it this way. Don't try to combine them. And like all things, there may be the occasional exception to this. But as a general principle, it's a good principle. Also, don't try to combine religious paths. Follow one path. When you find the teacher that suits you, follow that teacher. And don't use what I call a shotgun approach, where you just figure throwing more stuff at it is going to help it. Because more religious stuff isn't going to help it either. More religious teaching, more religious practices isn't going to deal with that need. Once you've found meditation, you've got the essential thing. Once you've taken the precepts to heart, you've got the essential thing. Once you've found a path that's a definite path, being properly taught and practiced by someone somewhere, you've got the essential thing. Don't keep thinking that more is needed. Always more. It's not. What's needed is actually take a definite thing and do it wholeheartedly. Take a limited practice and do it wholeheartedly. And let it work. I'm not saying that ours is the only practice that enables this to work. There's others that work too. Now, personally, I found my teacher, and I can't imagine looking to another teaching or another teacher myself. I've never found anyone who explains this like my teacher did and helped me have enough experience that I can talk about it. I can't imagine myself coming to the level of experience where I can talk about it like this without the teacher I had. So you see, I'm limited. And I'm going to stay limited as a matter of choice. But if you can do one thing right in religion, then you can make progress. But if you can do a dozen things and not get any of them really right, you won't make progress. Once there has been the enlightening of need, then the story isn't over. There's a merit stream that comes down and that can pick up more need. And you have to realize that the Buddhist teaching of no self is essential for a real minimal kind of comprehension, which is all I ever have anyway, minimal of this process. This is a big mystery. But if you try to view this in terms of a self that has achieved something or realized something, it all falls apart. It's kind of like grabbing after soap bubbles. You know, you blow bubbles in the air, you know. It's like grasping at the bubble. You grab it and it pops in your hand. There's nothing for a self to achieve here. There's nothing to be achieved. There's no accumulation here. Nothing to accumulate. No enlightenment to accumulate. Again, when you recite the scripture of great wisdom tomorrow morning, listen to what it's saying. It's talking about this. If there's nothing to be accumulated, no self to be rewarded, well, why bother? Because there's no self to be rewarded. What does that mean? In the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, which I know nothing about except that Rev Master showed me his 3-volume thing that she'd been given as a gift from one of the monks many years ago, and I opened it and I saw these lines. I said, this is like a gift. So I know nothing about this sutra except about the death of the Buddha, the teaching the Buddha gave at his death or something, but this line leapt out at me, you know. When a person truly realizes the truth of no self, it is to realize the true self. Not all of it, but there's a couple other things too, but to realize the truth of no self is to realize true self. So to say that there's no self there is just to say that it's the eternal, and is enough to dissolve into the infinite love of the eternal and float in the current, to be carried in the current. And it's when the current goes down to the need part to is enough to know your need. When the current takes you up to the ecstasy part is enough to be at that place. Rim Basil tells a story about Rim Master meeting him in the cloister one day, and Rim Master saying, "How you doing, Rim Basil?" Basil said, "Well, not so good today," or something like that. And Master said, turned to him and looked at him, pointed at him. Didn't he? She point at you?
Yep.
Yeah, and said,
"I said to her, and I wasn't doing so. I said, I guess the normal ups and downs."
Yeah. And she said, "Basil, when you're up, be up. When you're down, be down." But when you're down, look up. And when you're up, don't be swollen-headed. There's nothing in it for you. And the more you let go of the you, the more there's in it for you. To know that one is loved, this is to know that you're loved beyond your power to comprehend. And that's enough. As soon as you try to grasp after any aspect of it, it's gone. It's gone. I know this because I've tried so many times. It's gone. It's gone. And one day you become so grateful for that need because that need takes you back through it again, over and over again. Instead of hating it and dreading it, you're grateful for it. But it doesn't mean that you enjoy certain parts of it. That's what I'm always talking about. I realize that. But it probably helps me to talk about it, whether it helps anyone to hear about it or not, for the umpteenth time.